welcome to Good Night Sweetcast. This is the first 58 podcasts where we will be looking at
the trials and tribulations of Gary Sparrow
and his journeys through time in the BBC sitcom Good Night Sweetheart.
In what we've called Good Night Sweetcast.
See what we've done there?
Yeah.
Already, I'm pretty certain that I'm going to get those two muddled up the entire time. I'm already doing it.
It's already happened a few times. The theme tune has already caused me stress headaches.
You heard a little bit of Good Night Sweetheart as we started. The original version, made famous by Al Bowley. It's not quite the version that appeared on the series. You might recognise our voices from the Wiki Shuffle podcast, which is where I, Philip Sharman, your host today, and Chris Wallace, who's joining me.
Hello.
That's where we cut our podcasting teeth. But really, we were just building up to this moment where we could spend our time talking about the 1990s sitcom phenomena of Good Night, Sweetheart. As you might expect, we're kicking things off with episode one. Season one, episode one, the pilot, if you will, entitled Rites of Passage. The overriding theme of the entire series is that Gary Sparrow has lots of rights that the rest of humanity isn't privileged to, because he is the centre of his own universe.
Yes. Very hard done by man, he thinks.
So episode one first aired on the 18th of November, 1993.
I was 5.
And I was 13. So how, you're probably asking yourself, are we going to find enough material to talk about for 58 episodes worth of Good Night, Sweetheart?
Yes, how are we going to do that?
Well, that remains to be seen.
Mm.
Personally, when we first said we were going to do this, and if you have a listen back to episode 77 of Wiki Shuffle, you'll hear the moment where we first said that we were going to endeavour to watch all of Good Night, Sweetheart.
So you've done it
already. It's happened already. At that point, you were on board from day one. This was just something that seemed like a good idea to you straight away.
I get on board with a lot of things early on. I'm very much an early adopter until it comes to fruition. And then my opinion may vastly change. But not the case with this, because Good Night, Sweetheart is it's a very interesting programme.
My first reaction when we said that we were going to do this was, I'm not sure that I can do this because I thought that we'd just spend our time mocking. And so straight away, I want to set the tone of this podcast isn't about mocking, because we've both grown strangely fond of the show.
I'm very fond of the show. And we've just watched the first episodes again. And I do not like to watch the pilot of things more than once, because I do get attached to the characters. And they don't know each other in this one, and it makes me feel sad in my heart. I have grown to care about Gary, even though he's a bit of a dick.
And so it made you feel sad to see them in their naive state.
Yeah, they don't know what's happened, what's gone on. And as we all know, you can't put a butterfly back in its chrysalis. You shouldn't.
You definitely shouldn't. That's good advice. So the way we're going to go about this, we've already watched the whole series, but we're going to rewatch each episode before we talk about it. We're going to try and keep it spoiler-free beyond the episode that we're talking about as best we can.
And it would be nice if you can watch it with us.
So we're starting off with Season 1, Episode 1, Rites of Passage, which we get to meet our characters for the first time. And those characters are
Gary, the main character.
Our protagonist, Gary Sparrow, who is played by Nicholas Lyndhurst, who you may recognise from such shows as
Only Fools and Horses.
Or Butterflies.
Or New Tricks.
Or The Piglet Files.
Just think of that man you've seen from the sitcoms who's got a really long face and always looks a bit, like, hard done by. That's Nicholas Lyndhurst.
There is nobody in the country of Great Britain who does not know who Nicholas Lyndhurst is.
No, of course not.
So I don't think we need to worry about
it. National treasure.
Yeah, kind of.
It is a bit.
But as celebrities go, I know nothing about him.
It's a mystery.
Another thing that we're hoping to do as this show progresses is maybe get some of the cast and crew to guest. And we're holding out that maybe Nicholas Lyndhurst.
I just said he had a long face. Long, sad face.
I don't think you're the first to say that.
No.
And that's not an insult in and of itself.
You can have a long, sad face and be a nice man. I'm sure he is. Can't wait to meet you.
Looking forward to it. We're reaching out.
Mm-hmm.
Set the scene for us. Where do we start in episode one?
Episode one begins with a party for Gary's birthday in his house he shares with his wife and some proper 90s tunes.
I reckon this is the worst party since Charles and Di's 10th wedding anniversary. I mean, where is everyone? Where are the faces?
In the kitchen, of course. You remember that old Jonah Louie record?
You will always find me in the kitchen at home.
Yeah. I wonder what became of Jonah Louie.
Probably still in the kitchen. Why is it whenever you go to a party, there's a completely empty living room and yet the kitchen's like the Black Hole of Cricklewood?
I think you mean Calcutta.
Yeah, I know. Well, I just said Cricklewood because, you know, this is Cricklewood. By way of being a joke, really.
So we're having a party. It's Gary's birthday and he's having a party. He's not very pleased about this party that's going on.
Because of his bloody wife.
And all the actions going on in the kitchen. But what is happening is a friendship is being forged. Mm. A friendship that will stand the test of time, or at least 58 episodes.
Mm.
Because for the first time, Gary is meeting his soulmate.
Good old Ron. The reliable, friendly face of adultery.
Which is really strange, because if you look at their relationship as the series goes on, you do not imagine that these are two people that have only just met.
It does come across like they're more like childhood friends.
They actually meet cute with a rather inappropriate joke about Yvonne's bottom. In the audio commentary that accompanies the DVD, the writers, Morris Gran and Lawrence Marks, admit that the very first scene, the one in the party, really doesn't quite work for them. It's a bit too long, and they do actually regret that the two characters didn't know each other previously, and the whole thing would make a bit more sense if they did. We learn a lot about Gary very quickly on.
We learn that he's very sad. He's a very sad man. He comes across as someone who's quite insecure, and he feels, what's the word for when you're not feeling like a man?
Emasculated.
That's the one. That's how he feels. Is that how all men felt in the 90s?
As a man of the 90s, did I feel emasculated? I don't know that my masculinity levels are really high enough for me to be able to be a good yardstick there. But there was New Lad Culture, that was a thing. Loaded magazine.
Yep.
Denise Van Outen was a thing.
Yeah, she was a thing. She was a big thing.
So we're setting this in its place. He says so much himself that there's no rites of passage for young men in the 1990s.
Yeah, that's the name of the episode.
Uh-huh. Not like his dad had to do, who had national service, and not like his granddad who fought in the war.
Yeah.
So this was a different time. This was men couldn't be men. We meet Gary. We meet Ron. We meet Yvonne, the wife. Tell us about Yvonne.
Yvonne, she's not learned much in this episode. Yeah, the only times you see her is when she's coming into the living room because Gary's put some of his oldie jazz on or whatever, and she wants to get back to Two Unlimited. So she tells him off for that. Then she goes back in the kitchen, wiggling her bum, which Ron likes that. And then later on, I think she moans at him. And then there's this weird bit just before he goes through the time tunnel where he has a moment in bed with his wife, and she's studying for her course, and she doesn't want to consummate the marriage because she's busy. She's learning. She's enriching their brain instead of enriching Gary's penis.
I mean, it's quite strange that she's chosen to do this after a party. The party's all finished. She's been having a whale of a time, dancing away in the kitchen to Two Unlimited.
What better way to have a party?
Round it off with a bit of Open University.
Yeah, I'll get that course done.
Gary feels a certain entitlement to some... There's a phrase Gary likes to use, a specific phrase. It's not one that's in common usage today, I wouldn't say. But it does sum up his attitude to sex quite nicely, which is he wants to get his leg over.
He very much wants to get his leg right over there.
And that's about as loving and involved as their relationship seems to be.
Nevertheless, Gary is still a horrible man in this situation. And this opening scenes, yeah, I sort of feel a bit of sympathy. A little bit of sympathy for him. But then watching that scene, it just came across like he's a bit of a knobhead.
What Goodnight Sweetheart does so well and so consistently and much more knowingly than my memory of the show gives it credit for is Gary Sparrow is both a terrible human being and yet still remains sympathetic and quite likeable.
It's a gift Nicholas Lyndhurst has.
The writers in the first episode say very clearly they never had in mind anybody other than Nicholas Lyndhurst for this role, despite the fact they'd never worked with him before. They knew that Nicholas Lyndhurst was the man that they wanted for this job. And you can see why. That kind of innocence about him, he probably doesn't know better. And that his intentions aren't intrinsically bad, they're just clueless. He doesn't understand that he isn't actually the centre of the universe. And everything conspires to reiterate that actually he might be.
He sounds like a psychopath.
there's something quite psychopathic about quite a lot of his actions. Mm. And you see that right from the first episode, so we'll look into those a little bit more, because he doesn't dally around in really setting out his stall of the kind of man that he is. But moving on from the party, we get thrown into the deep end pretty quickly.
Gary is a TV repairman. He fixes the big tellies off of the 90s. In the sort of mid-90s, those things were starting to get faded out. So on top of him feeling like less of a man, he's also getting pushed out of his trade at the same time.
He's not happy. He's not in a happy place. He doesn't feel like he's being particularly constructive in what he's contributing to the world. He's going to do a job, and he needs to go off to the East End to do this job. He turns up in his van in East London, and he doesn't know where he's going because sat-nav doesn't exist because it's the 1990s.
Oh, yes, of course.
There's a very poor joke about
the crease.
The crease in the A to Z. Observational humour.
Good work there.
Lost on us because A to Z.
What is that?
And so he asks a policeman for directions because he can't find where he's going to.
This policeman is the only character that appears in both times, but they are two different people played by the same actor, PC Deadman.
And PC Deadman's grandson, PC Deadman.
Who is identical to PC Deadman. Like Jack Nicholson in The Shining. Same thing.
PC Deadman gives him directions to where he needs to go.
Duckett's Passage.
Duckett's Passage. So off he wanders down Duckett's Passage.
Off screen, so he just walks. You don't see him go through anything. He doesn't like fall in a time hole.
There's no fancy special effects.
No Doctor Who things.
No, there's no swirling music or discombobulation at the action.
I can imagine if I was going to do it. I'm not the director of this particular episode, but if I was the director of this episode, I would like him to be like, you'd see his full body and then he'd be twirling around, going, whoa, and a big purple splash in the background where he gets sucked in. They didn't do that.
Or, alternatively, a full-on Terminator-style crouched nude Lyndhurst arriving in the past.
Yeah, that
was another possibility that they must have diced with, but didn't make the final cut.
That's a shame.
I mean, we've not seen all of the DVD bonus features. Maybe they shot that version and we just haven't seen it yet. We've wandered down Duckett's Passage and suddenly it's 1940.
Science.
I really like the fact that they don't ever go into any real detail of how why this happens. Yeah. Let's just ignore it. It happens. It's immaterial, really. It's the consequences that matter. And I think it's quite brave to do that, to say, this doesn't matter. This just happens. Get over it. Unsurprisingly, Gary's first reaction upon being in the 1940s is to not notice at all.
Because he is very self-centred and inside himself, his universe is him, that he wouldn't notice what was going on around him.
I think that's it. I think that's it. He doesn't even look up or double take at the cart horses that are all around him all of a sudden, or street urchins that are wandering around. That's fine. He just wanders into this pub completely oblivious, only interested in his directions and nothing else.
Gormless. Is that how you describe him?
There's a bit of that, but that suggests that he's stupid, and he's definitely not.
No, he's a high-level psychopath.
He's high-functioning. He's very clever. Not quite as clever as he thinks he is.
No, because some of the things he does are stupid, are completely stupid.
So he wanders into the pub to ask for directions, because that's what you had to do before mobile phones. And lo and behold, inside the pub, some 40s people.
Some 40s old people.
Hugh Gates Go House, anyone? You're a starter for 10? Skip. Oh, it's a theme pub, isn't it? Of course it is. Yeah, very convincing.
Oh, hello. Haven't seen you in here before. What can I get you?
Actually, I just came in for directions. I'm looking for Hugh Gates Go House.
Oh, sorry, means nothing to me. You sure it's round here?
Well, I asked a copper. He said it was just round the corner.
Sorry. Oh, Dad might know, though. He knows everything, he thinks. Dad!
Off and Mo, I'm coming up. What is it?
Oh, this gentleman wants to know where Hugh Gateskill lives.
Hugh Gateskill? Don't ring a bell with me. Is this Hugh Gateskill a regular?
No, not Hugh Gateskill. Hugh Gateskill House. It's a tower block.
A what?
Specifically old people, because all the youngsters are off fighting in the war, with the exception of the lovely Dervla Kerwin.
Dervla Kerwin.
Who is manning the bar at the Royal Oak Pub. Now, one of the things we learnt from the director commentary is that the Royal Oak pub was an actual pub, actually called the Royal Oak.
But do we know if it still is?
I want us to find out, because okay. If it is, we will definitely be recording a future episode from the Royal Oak pub. So we meet Phoebe.
And her dad.
And her dad, Eric. Gary's first response upon entering the Royal Oak is to assume that it's some sort of theme pub.
Yeah, which is reasonable. The first thing you would assume.
Even when it starts to get a bit weird and it becomes more apparent that this is actually 1940, he steps outside and has a look around and sees a...
Is that a blimp? Huh?
I think it was some kind of... What's a barrage balloon?
I don't know. You were there.
A barrage balloon is a large balloon anchored to the ground by cables and typically with netting suspended from it, serving as an obstacle to low-flying enemy aircraft.
We got introduced to Phoebe. Gary also got introduced to Phoebe for the first time. And he does what everyone does when they meet someone they fancy. He looked at the top of her head and then ran to the bottom of her feet and then back up to the top of her head and then just stared at her. That's how you do it, isn't it? That's what you do. Wait and then hope for the best.
And what does he get? He gets the best.
He does.
Because she seems to melt pretty much immediately at the boiler-suited Nicholas Lyndhurst. Melter. We've bypassed the first instance of Gary Sparrow being a not very nice human, which was, it was his birthday, and Yvonne got him a lovely present.
She did. She got him a pen. If someone got me a pen for my birthday,
You'd react like Gary Sparrow did.
Yeah, I would give it to the first...
Because he was a bit of a dick about it.
Yes, I would give it to the first landlord that I saw.
He goes back in time with this pen in hand, and he hasn't got any money to pay for his drink, because he hasn't got any oldie money. If you're wondering... Tuppence farthing. That's how much half a pint costs in 1940.
We've gone so far in time that I don't know what that means.
Tuppence is 2 pence.
I did not know that.
And a farthing. I don't know how much a farthing was. Like a quarter penny?
I feel like you should know this, Phil.
No, I absolutely shouldn't.
These things were around when you were a young lad. I know they were.
The farthing is a monetary unit and coin of the UK withdrawn in 1961.
Your years?
No, not my years. Equal to a quarter of an old penny. So 2¼ pence for half a pint of mild. If you're wondering how much money to take back with you when you're wandering through Duckett's Passage, the answer is 2¼ pennies per half pint. So there's a lot to get into this first episode. It's a very effective pilot.
Oh, yeah. It tells you the characters, it tells you their state of mind, it tells you what the premise is, which is quite a big premise. It does it all in a nice little package and then leads on to what, by the end of it, you know what the situation from episode to episode is going to involve. Gary Sparrow, his current time wife, his love interest from the 40s, his enabler.
Ron the enabler.
Yeah.
He facilitates.
Facilitates.
He facilitates every step of the way.
There's a lot of strange relationships in this programme. Was that what it was like in the 90s?
Yeah.
Just strange relationships, okay.
That's what being a human being is like.
Yeah, true.
So they've got that down. Having seen the barrage balloon and decided that, yes, this actually does look as though it isn't a theme pub, it's real life, the way that Gary's mind handles that, despite all of the evidence being thrown at him, rather than being freaked out or scared or reacting or speaking the truth to anybody and asking questions, he decides it's a dream. People can tell the difference between dreams and reality. But he can't. He is prepared to tell himself that this is a dream rather than have a difficult conversation with anybody.
At some level, he must know dreams aren't like that. You don't do your dreams. You don't, like,
you don't
them. You don't do them.
You don't do your dreams.
Your brain house does them. This is what makes me think he's a psychopath, because he goes, well, I can do what I like.
The alternative to him saying that it's a dream is for him to admit that he's scared at something weird's going on and show some sort of vulnerability to anybody else that is around him. So what a normal functioning human being would do at this stage, they would get freaked out, they would try to persuade the people around them that something crazy has gone on, maybe get their support and work with them so that they could forge some relationships and get through this trouble with other people. Mm-hmm. What he does is just shut down within himself. mouth and pretend to be Elton John. That's not a rational response to a crisis. One of the rules, and there's not many rules, but one of the rules is only Gary's allowed to go back and forth through this portal, whatever it is. He's the only one because he's special. So we don't get to compare his reactions to a normal person's reactions in this circumstance because we don't get to see anybody else doing it. So we're presenting this as if maybe this is okay and maybe you would react like this. Whereas actually, no, you wouldn't. No right-thinking, sensible person would react in this way. There is something a little bit broken about this man, that he cannot actually connect with people well enough and on a level that will help him in any way. And we're learning all of this in episode one.
They're doing that right from the get-go.
So now we get an air raid. At this point, things get a bit more real. He has to go down into the cellar of the Royal Oak to hide from the air raid. And he wakes up because he has a bit of a panic attack about the fact that he's claustrophobic.
There was a good joke.
The best joke of the episode.
Look, I haven't got a gas mask because I'm a claustrophobic, all right?
Oh, so now he's claiming he's from a neutral country.
That was a good joke. I like that. I like it because for the rest of it, the jokes are not... But that one, that's a proper joke.
So down in the cellar, he comes to and he wakes up and says, oh, it's all been a dream. As he comes round in the cellar, he thinks he's waking up from his dream, says about this cracking bit of stuff. Creepy, which presumably he thought he was saying this to his wife.
Yeah, which is another level of the weird Gary Sparrow brain. You wouldn't describe that to your wife that way.
You'd hope not.
Like Gary doesn't care about anybody but himself.
So he comes to, they have a sing-song, he helps them get through, and his ego is massaged to such an extent that he is now the centre of the universe. Everybody loves him instantly because he's teaching them all these songs that he's passing off as his own, which is a running joke. Maybe an overly run joke.
It would have worked a couple of times, but I think...
They overdo this suggestion that he passes up, which again, at centre of the universe, he was responsible for every act of creative genius that's ever happened. He does it in such a nonplussed way, as if it's nothing as well. It's not as if he does it with a false sense of pride.
It's almost as if he's used to lying, and it's something he does daily.
So we've established early on that he's got his eye on this barmaid, Phoebe, by his visual signals.
Look up, look down, look up again, tilt head.
The head tilt's probably to get some pheromones out.
Yeah, that's how you get them out.
Imagine that there's some sort of pheromone gland there that he's just sort of wafting in her direction.
In your neck.
It's a very effective gland. I think his must be hyperactive in some way because it certainly does the trick. He establishes pretty much immediately, before any sort of relationship, before he knows anything about her, the very first thing he knows about this woman is that she has a husband who's fighting in the war in Tunisia. He literally does not take a beat upon hearing that news.
Nope, and doesn't faze him at all.
It matters to him not one jot that she has a husband in Tunisia fighting in the war. To be fair, it doesn't seem to matter that much to her either.
Because he popped the pheromone in her face.
Cut him his due. He didn't just get a slap in the face. And she was clearly quite taken by his exotic ways.
That's probably the pheromones talking.
They're taking over her body. That's
what they do.
Zombie possession. Nicholas Lyndhurst's pheromones. I need to stop confusing the human being Nicholas Lyndhurst and the abominable character Gary Sparrow, because they're not the same.
We've never met him. He might have a gland.
So yeah, he becomes the hero. Everybody loves him.
Balance is restored.
He is rewarded for all of his lies and deception. Understandably, he quite likes this. I think I would too. Who doesn't like being the centre of attention? Everybody likes that. He... still not very scared by the event at this point, because he stayed for a drink after the air raid. He saved Derek's life. We've missed out the fact that he saved Derek's life.
He's an animal, as PC Deadman said. He pulled him off him.
He was doing some mouth-to-mouth resuscitation after Phoebe's dad was hit by a cash register.
I'm not like an expert on medicals, but I don't know if the kiss of life is necessary for that injury.
In the same way as we need to skirt over the science fiction aspects, we might need to skirt over the medical truisms of the need for mouth-to-mouth resuscitation in that particular scenario for any reason than comic effect.
Yeah, I mean, but that feels like it might just be a sitcom trope. You could also then set up for the joke of, like, that man's kissing that man.
It didn't feel like they were mean in that joke.
No. No, it was a very quick thing, and you can tell that they just wanted to throw that little joke in there. It quickly went to, how do you know this stuff from America? Which, yeah. Again, becomes a writing tool for them. From America is their way of getting anything done in this programme.
I feel like, as this is the first episode that we're doing here, that we need to stand up in the defence of the show,
mm-hmm.
because I'm sure a lot of people will imagine that it's a lot worse than it was from the memory. There, in particular, the fact that they didn't labour the joke of, oh, two men kissing, that's disgusting,
yeah.
is very reflective of the fact that the political correctness, although not at 2016 levels by any means, certainly mm-hmm. the joke about his wife's bum and the general attitude towards women and sex is dated. It's not ever mean-spirited or outright homophobic. It's actually very well considered on that. There isn't any point in any of the coming episodes where I remember feeling offended at all.
It was just, that looks old. Look at those crap carpets.
You're offended by the carpets.
I was offended by the crap carpets,
yeah,
and chairs.
I have no doubt that we will be talking about interior design at length in future
episodes.
They open
the episode with a shot of Gary Sparrow wearing what appears to be some sort of Venn diagram. And he just sat there with his little Venn diagram tucked into his really high-waisted jeans. And Ron walks out in that thing, which I'm guessing this was a 90s thing. I definitely don't remember it. Where they shirts were massive then? Is that how it works?
Ron is...
Just lived in them?
Ron is a fairly massive guy.
Yeah, but he was wearing effectively a tent. Big collars.
Yeah, the ubiquitous rugby shirt, which will be making plenty more appearances as the show goes
Hooray.
On. So he's had his sing-along. He's stumbled out of the pub.
They did that thing where he walks out of the pub and you can hear inside everyone's like, oh, come back, Gary, give us another one of your tunes. When are you coming to see us again? Don't forget to drop in. Oh, he's like, oh, I'm the best, I am. So trots off, looking a bit confused, but still proud of himself.
A little bit cautious about whether or not he's going to get back into the future as well.
That never crossed his mind, really, when you think about it. Yeah. He didn't think that far ahead.
Well, no, as with everything else in his life, he just assumed everything would be fine. And it was. Phoebe makes an appearance outside the pub,
mm-hmm.
gives him a kiss on the cheek, rather suggestively. Off he pops back to 1993.
Mm-hmm.
Just like that.
Through the time tunnel.
Presumably drove home, not sure I'm okay with that. Makes it home to Yvonne, who's been worried about him because he's been out all night. And this moment, and it's good that they get there straight away in the first episode, here's the pivot. The pivot that the entire forthcoming six seasons all boils down to. This is the moment at which he should have told the truth. He had the opportunity for coming clean at this point to tell the truth. Everything that happened subsequently would be fine if he was a rational human being.
But he's not. He's Gary Sparrow.
Centre of his own universe, Gary Sparrow.
Time traveller, Gary Sparrow.
And that's why it's an interesting show. Because nobody wants to watch programmes about real people and what people would actually do. So there we have it. Season 1, episode 1 of Goodnight Sweetcast, Rites of Passage.
Not the best episode of Goodnight Sweetcast.
It isn't, but it's a funny old business doing a pilot. You've got a lot of work to get done.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that work very effectively. You know where you are and what you're getting.
And it does end with him saying, good night, sweetie.
So it's a little bit on the nose. It perhaps could have done without it as he looks into the mirror at the lipstick still on his cheek and says good night, sweetheart, to his wife whilst thinking about
Phoebe. Looks himself up and down, tilts his head a bit, releases some of his little pheromones, says good night, sweetheart, and then she's immediately unconscious.
Thank you for listening. We would love your feedback on what you want us to do with this podcast. We're going to try and keep them fairly short and snappy because there's only so much that you can listen to about good night, sweetheart. We hope very much that you watch along. We really would like to hear from you with any of your thoughts about any of the episodes that we've covered. One important feature that we would really like your participation in is that we are going to be opening up the Gary Lurie.
What?
The Gary Lurie.
The Gary Lurie.
The Gary Lurie.
Gary Lurie. Gary Lurie.
The Gary Lurie.
Gary Lurie. Okay. I'll get better.
Which is where we will be inviting you to submit your own Goodnight Sweetheart artwork.
Fan art.
Fan art. That's what it's called.
Yeah. Eroticism is optional.
Yeah, we can have just a picture of Gary Sparrow's big pheromone-shooting gland.
Oh, yeah, because there is a Rule 34, isn't there? So there probably exists something. There's some sort of Gary Sparrow porn. And if there's not, make it for us. Make us Gary Porn.
You're more enthusiastic about that than me, but at the same time, that's what we want. We want your participation. So please do. It will end up on our Gary Lurie wall. We're both working on artworks ourselves at the moment.
Mm-hmm. I've done a nice picture, Gary.
We will see you again next week when we'll do episode 2.
Good Night Sweetcast is a Wiki Shuffle podcast. You can follow us on Facebook, on Twitter at GNSCast, or find out more at goodnightsweetcast.com.